Hello everyone, you're listening to the Sticks and Stakes Cricket Podcast. Join us in the virtual pub, where in a week the Royals hit the headlines, we'll be trying to stay on the topic of Test match cricket.
The thing that annoys me about Prince Charles Moore is when he turns up to all these ceremonial events with those medals on his chest, and he hasn't won a single medal for any valour in combat. He's like a banana republic, isn't he?
He's not like you, Krabby, with all those medals you've won for all your valour in combat.
I don't wear them all over my chest, do I? Get his tongue out Greta Thunberg's arse and do something useful for once.
Join the ranks of specialist fielders, net bowlers and county cricket enthusiasts as we take on the cricketing establishment and fly up the podcast rankings.
What number are we in the charts?
Last time I checked, we dropped out of the top 100. But I do suspect that's largely because we haven't actually done a podcast in about 10 days. So all the other tens of podcasts have all been churning out content. I'm sure we'll be back in the top 10 before we know it.
This week, we'll be looking back on England's winter in the subcontinent. We will be rating the players, discussing our dream commentary team, and Johnny Hilliard brings in his personal experience when we debate whether it's worth taking a hat-trick if it means getting hit for six sixes in a row, as poor Dallinger da Silva found out to his cost last week. Wherever in the world you're listening from, we hope you enjoy it. So, let's meet the team. Hey chaps, how are we doing?
Good, thanks mate, how are you?
Very well. We're going to look back on the winter in the subcontinent as a whole. So a bit of a winter of two halves, if you like, with three tests where Joe Root scored a double hundred pretty much every game, and then three tests where he didn't, and we got roundly beaten in the end there by India. Let's look back on some player ratings. Should we start at the top and look at the opening partnership? So we've got Burns played a couple of games, Dom Sibley, and then Zach Crawley also played. Let's start there.
So Burns got 58 runs, an average of 15. So I'm not sure that's great, is it? Let's be honest. I think he has been poor. Poor, you know, you can't really give him much more than a D, I think, for his performances.
A D for his performance. He did play in a pretty tough one on that second test match pitch, and then was perhaps because of the abuse he received on this podcast, quite rightly dropped after that, and maybe has become a better player by not playing in the next two. Do you think?
Yeah, but he's also got a terrible lid, so that surely rounds him down to a D minus.
I think D minus is quite complimentary. 14.5 average. Why is this? Especially an England batsman.
That might be the highest of the openers, though.
No, Sibley got 17, and Zach Crawley got 17 as well.
Okay. Excellent. So, yeah, really strong performance in the top three. I think it was, am I right in saying it's up there in about the top five worst averages of the top three since the records began?
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, sounds about right. Lawrence had a game at three as well, and he was poor as well.
And Bairstow.
We could probably have a whole conversation on number three and England's troubles with that in itself. Dan Lawrence is an interesting one because he did score a 50 in the last game. Kind of in a losing cause when the game was well and truly done, but
he looked all right in that last test. I think he could be pushing Pope for that number six slot in the summer, but he clearly can't bat at three. If he found out, but
this is the problem that England have had, is they're trying to pick middle order batsmen. Bairstow is another example. The guy, he never bats at three for his county. Neither does Lawrence. There's a reason why they don't. They're not top order players, and we keep seeing this number three slot as a middle order for a middle order batsman. It's just, you're not really giving these guys a chance.
It was also a bit unfortunate that they picked Lawrence at three in the one game where there was pace and he's kind of a better player against spin, and so sort of he got knocked over, I think, by Bumrah, didn't he? Like, did he get a pair, or he certainly got out, I think, first ball in one innings, and yet he maybe could do a job at three, like on the spinning pitches that we saw later on. But I mean, he's definitely not going to be a three for English conditions, and he'd never played there for Essex. So yeah, I can see that argument. So how would we rate Dan Lawrence against Rory Burns, D minus?
I think he's probably slightly better. C minus, maybe.
D minus.
It's not great, but an improvement over Burns.
And we're going to really have to stretch the scale a little bit to rate Johnny Bairstow.
Zed.
Yeah.
Like, there's no like, F. He's not going to play for England again, is he?
What comes after Z? You know, when they do the Hurricanes, when they run out of names, they go to Alpha, Beta, Gamma. I mean, Johnny Bairstow's one of them, isn't he?
Almost. He'll probably come out and smoke it in the T20s and the one days.
Yeah. He's a brilliant white ball player.
In his defence, and I'm not a great Bairstow fan, but he did come out mid-series having just been mincing around in West Yorkshire, and he's come into what must be some of the most challenging conditions in world cricket when the ball's turning that much.
Mm.
But they were still dreadful shots. That's can't get past that.
He did play in Sri Lanka, though, right? He played in Sri Lanka, went home.
Did okay in Sri Lanka.
No, he did. I mean, that rest definitely didn't help him. That's certainly, if you like, the only narrative that can save him, I think, save his test career is
England's poor management of him.
England, exactly, yeah. I'm not sure how well that'll go down with the selectors playing that narrative. Be interesting to know the meeting that they have about that. So, Johnny, what do you put your performance down to?
You.
You guys, actually. Yeah. So, who haven't we got? Zach Crawley? We all had such a promising hope for Zach
Crawley.
Great
in that one innings, didn't he?
Yeah, one innings, but he came back in and he looked tremendous. He's made some
beautiful
shots.
About the same as Lawrence.
Yeah, maybe slightly better than Lawrence. I think he's got more potential than Lawrence.
He looks better.
I think we might see him opening in the summer, to be honest, rather than batting at three.
For me, he should play at three.
He said himself he prefers three as well. He's the one guy who actually does bat there.
He's the only one that actually wants to.
Yeah.
So let's put everyone else under the sun there.
Give him a go. Yeah, you'd have thought. And so we're missing out. We haven't rated Dom Sibley as well, who has stuck around at the top of the order for the whole winter.
He looked good in that first test, right? I think he got an 80, didn't he?
Or 85 or something.
He only got 134 runs in the series. So 85 of them came in that one innings on the first test.
And it was
so
a flat
outside
pitch.
Of that, yeah, I'm not sure. I think they probably stick with him for the summer. I think he's probably slightly ahead of Burns in the pecking order now. But he's on borrowed time, I think, as well, unless he scores some runs in the summer.
Well, the cupboard's pretty bare. I don't know who else. Like
Tom Lamonby, I told you about him before. I'm not joking. He's young and he looks the real deal. He scores runs against pace, against spin, and Burns and Sibley. They'll probably play them till the Ashes, though, won't they? They're not going to risk bringing in a youngster before the Ashes.
You know, if someone looks good in the county, I think they might give them a go.
They won't.
Hamid,
so
Hamid is fat.
Yeah,
he looked quite good last year in the county championship for the first time in about 4 years.
What did he average?
But last year was just a load of second 11 games. There was no actual proper players playing last year. There was a massive bubble of England players, so no one anywhere near the England team was involved.
That's true.
There were no Colpack players. There were no overseas players. The standard was significantly weaker.
Lancashire wanted him to do well as well, and they kept picking him. But he averaged for about 2 years. And I think I quote that one, the coach genuinely said he can't hit the ball off the square at the moment. I mean, he kind of...
Yeah, he's mentally was shot.
He lost all his confidence after that England call, didn't he? He made one score and then just couldn't, like you say, couldn't get it off the square after that.
Well, he broke his finger, didn't he? And he battled with... Yeah. Like, he had a brilliant India tour. And I think he was opening with Cook back... Like, it was actually quite a long time ago now. But... in 2016, he looked for all the world like he was going to be our future opener.
New Cook,
The average is 43 in Test cricket. So while his first class average is taking a nosedive, his Test average still looks decent.
Yeah. It'd be great to see him come back and do it. I just think you can't base it off. For me, you can't base it off last season where the standard just wasn't there.
Yeah, fair enough.
Here's an interesting one though for you guys though. Yeah. So we're talking about, you know, we're rightly criticising the England boys for their very low averages in this series. But what is, bearing in mind the scores have been low across the board, just looking at the Indian averages, you've got Sundar's got a fantastic run, partly because he's only had two completed innings. He's averaging 90. Sharma and Pant have both been unbelievably good. I think we can all agree on that. They're averaging in their mid-50s, which, you know, the mid-50s, on a regular series, that's more like an average of what? Mid-70s, mid-80s?
Mm-hmm. In this series,
average of 30 has got to be seen as a really, really good... I mean, Ashwin's at 31.5. Yeah. An average of 30 has got to be seen as a really good series average, and bearing in mind the conditions these two teams have been playing in.
Take out Sharma, who averaged 58, but Gill averaged 20 for India. Pujara averaged 22. Kohli averaged 29, which is probably reasonable given the pitches. But then Rahane averaged 19. So three out of their top five averaged pretty low.
Yeah. So let's go down. So obviously, Joe Root, tale of two halves in the winter for him. How do you rate his performance, both as a batsman and as a captain and leader of the team?
A B plus. Like, you know, he won us that first test single-handedly. His captaincy, I thought he was better captain than on the pitch than Kohli, but he got his selections wrong. I don't know. Can you put all the blame on selection with him?
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't think you can put that on his.
Should we handle then the selection issue while we're talking about captaincy and that lot? Because I think you can make a fair argument that is almost where we won and lost the series.
Discuss. I'm not sure quite go as far as won and lost, because I think we were second best in all departments, really. So I don't think just slightly different selections would have turned it around that much, but we didn't give ourselves a full chance.
That was the frustrating thing, wasn't it? It was not giving the players on the pitch really the chance either. Are you talking here in terms of the squads they had available to select from or the makeup of the team itself?
Both. It's just strange. You win a test match so handsomely like we did in the first one. And did we make four changes for the next one? That just seems I know it's all the COVID rotation, but it just seems strange to just change a winning formula.
It also just seems strange to me that did we not expect it to be turning for significant parts of this tour and then to essentially only pick two spinners for half the series? Ridiculous. I mean, how they can justify that, I just don't understand.
And that was compounded by picking Moeen for one game, and then you've ruined Dom Best's confidence because you didn't pick him for the second one after he'd taken 8 wickets. I mean, I think even us on the podcast, even though we'd slagged him off for his full tosses a little bit, I think we named the first episode after it, but I think all of us were still picking him in the second test. So it really was quite a harsh call. Quite a harsh call, that one, on a raging turner of a pitch as well. Can't have been great seeing Jay Root take 5 for 8. Didn't rate Root there for his bowling as well, actually. Perhaps
I'd give Root a higher mark than Chaser has. I think he pretty much won the Sri Lanka series single-handedly. And I think he's, won the first test.
Yeah.
Not far off single-handedly as well. He's struggled a bit since then, but everyone has. I don't think you can really say that Root's done a huge amount wrong.
I hit a double ton every game.
Yeah, he's set too high a standard. If he'd done 3 double tons in the last 3 games... We'd obviously
have lost by 150 and maybe 5 wickets.
Krabby, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, he didn't score many runs in the last couple of tests, did he, really? I think he was a bit knackered. His back was probably a bit sore from carrying Sibley, Crawley, and the rest of them. But no, it was strange, all those selection dramas. And I was actually just looking at Zach Crawley's career stats. And if he hadn't scored that 267, his average would only be 20 in test matches, as opposed to 34 as it is now. So he does look a good player, Crawley, and he is one for the next 10 years or so. He's just riding off that one knock at the moment.
Fair play to him.
He does need to start doing it a bit more consistently, for sure.
Yeah. Big summer. They quite like him, though, don't they?
I like him. I think he's doing good. I'd like to see him bowl a bit as well. Because that height, if he gets it coming down there, he bowls off breaks, apparently. It's going to be getting some serious bounce. So it's just what we need, really.
I also think we've got a new feature here, which is Krabby saying, "I'm just looking at," and we all have to guess what it is that Krabby could possibly be looking at right now. Seems to be just anyone's bowled off spin at the moment.
He's bowled 66 balls in county cricket. And he's only gone for 33 runs. So, I mean, he's got a better economy rate than Bess and Leach, I think.
How many wickets has he got there, Krabby?
It's not about wickets, is it? It's about economy. He's yet to take one, but he's only about 10 overs or so.
Stokes.
Oh, Stokes.
Yeah. Name of the podcast. He didn't quite live up to it, did he?
He bowled well in the last game, did okay with the bat. He averaged 25 or so throughout the series, which, again, if we're saying that 30 is the benchmark of a good score, it's not great, but it's not woeful. Certainly better than others.
Yeah. He did really try hard in that last game, didn't he? He kind of literally put himself on his knees bowling 25 overs in a day.
The shade of pink that he managed to go was just quite incredible. I don't know if that was sunburn or just from being a ginger, but that was, quite incredible.
Fair play. So, onto the keepers. Butler and Folks. Butler's got kind of the nice record of having won three games and Frakes has lost three. Not really.
We've missed Ollie Pope.
Oh shit! Yeah.
Ordinary.
He had a pretty forgetful tour himself, though, didn't he? To be honest,
there's not much to say about him, especially short leg, five catches or something.
Yeah, he got a lot of catches, but
yeah,
not a great series for him.
Possibly his best moment was sort of ducking and the ball bouncing off his back from Rahane and getting caught mid wicket.
Yeah,
he peaked. That's when he peaked.
He needs to go back to Surrey and score some runs against Glamorgan and Derbyshire and not all those really good counties.
On Peter a road at the Oval.
Peter Trago coming in off a couple of paces.
You can score runs against Peter Trago, get him in the team.
Lawrence v Pope, who would you pick if you had to play on the test side for Neither.
I still, yeah, I still think Pope's got a good future.
I think he'll come through, yeah. I agree with you, Chris. He does need to score some runs though, because if he has a disappointing summer, the Aussies are going to fucking murder him next year.
Oh, if he does, I think if he has a disappointing, first two or three tests, I think he's under real pressure.
Yeah, agreed.
From anyone scoring county cricket runs. Nice. So onto the keepers. Butler. So
we have Josh Butler, 54 runs at 27. Ben Folkes at 78 runs at 16, but got three stumpings to Butler's none.
Thanks, Stato. He did a good job of whipping the bails off while the batsman has his back foot planted in the crease, doesn't he?
Looks good. I think Butler's benefited from just not being in the team. His stock has risen since Folkes has just managed to lose with England.
And it might have been tough watching Butler keep on those pitches.
That's the thing. Folkes is clearly a better gloveman, and that's great, but you don't need that, A1 keeping when you're in England or Australia to the same degree you do when you're on the subcontinent. And the bottom line, he's had a chance and he's not delivered with the bat.
I mean, our opener's only averaged 15, and it wasn't easy for Folkes. He always came in tricky situations.
I think what you needed there, though, was someone to actually just go and play, like Pant, who just play a few shots. Like, you need like a match-changing 60. And Josh Butler, you would feel, is capable of doing that. If he decided to take on the spinners, for sure, he might play some stupid shots and get out. But he could play a match-winning innings, whereas Folkes, I think he did the best he could. Like, he hung around for 20 off 80 balls or something, I think, in the third test. Fine, but that was never going to get us back in the game.
He got stranded on 42 not out in that second test.
Yeah, he did all right.
There was a better argument for playing Folkes at three. He had a better defensive technique.
That's what the Indians were saying. Gavaskar was saying he should be batting at three.
He could potentially have been okay there, bearing in mind how poor the alternatives were. Might have worked quite nicely.
There we go. We should pick these sides now. It's not much easier in hindsight. We saw a lot of different bowlers use, obviously, rotation, particularly kind of came in there. Should we start off with our specialist number eight? Who are we back as our best number eight? I think we had...
Jack Leach.
Did Jack Leach bat there?
He's the best out of all of them. We played all three pace bowlers.
We had Jofra Archer.
He's terrible. Joe Root took more wickets than Jofra Archer. And he got 16 runs, an average of 4 batting. And he's down as an all-rounder. We play him as an all-rounder in that side at 8.
That is lower than Tufnell and Mullally, isn't it? And their career averages.
I mean, he's going
to
get
that. I don't think Archer did that badly with the ball. To average 30 as a seamer on those pitches isn't too bad.
I thought he looked really good in the first test. And then he didn't. That was it, wasn't he? He didn't play.
I almost think you also write off the seamers and you say Anderson was exceptional, Stone was very good, Archer and Stokes were okay, Broad didn't really get much of a go. That's kind of it. What more can you say? I mean, it's not really a fair contest.
It doesn't really tell you much about the side, does it? But perhaps good it is if we're looking towards the Ashes, which it seems that everything is, it does potentially represent a promising area, doesn't it? If Stone was probably the big plus in terms of you might actually genuinely have two 90 mile an hour bowlers for Brisbane.
Definitely. Probably puts a few nails in Mark Wood's coffin.
You've got it in for Mark Wood.
It's a long way from.
Yeah, but he can go play IPL now.
No, I think he's he's very amusing getting interviewed, but I and he's a very, very good one day player. And I have no problem with Northern as a huge fan of them. I just don't think Mark Wood is as good a bowler as he gets credit for. And I wouldn't put he wouldn't be anywhere near the team for me. When you've got Anderson, Broad, Archer, now Stone, Wokes, Wood's behind all of those guys in the pecking order. Look, he's a decent bowler. If he was from most other countries in the world, he'd probably have a good prospect of an international career. But
Are you playing Wokes ahead of Wood in the Ashes down under?
No.
In the day night I would. Wokes' record away from home is very poor. He's brilliant in English conditions.
Yeah.
I wouldn't pick him away. That said, he can bat, so you potentially put him in there. But in reality, and I've missed out Sam Curran in my earlier list. He's another one who's better than Wood. You probably pick Sam Curran ahead of Wokes away from home just because he can give you the left arm option as well.
Yeah, and we say he can bat against the second rate teams. I don't think against Cummins and Hazelwood and Stark he's going to score many runs.
No, but we're talking about number eight, number nine. I mean, he'll be a very good player for those positions. Bearing in mind we had Jofra Archer coming in at number eight in one of these games.
Fair enough. So let's finish it off then. So what pace bowler, should we just give him an overall whatever, C+? Yeah, well done. Yeah, spinners. So yeah, Leach obviously did well. Don Bess.
Probably needs to go back to county cricket, but he's so young. Yeah, he's going to come back and have another shot at England too, unless someone really incredible turns up. I don't think there's many spinners in the pipeline, are there?
The problem is he's going to have is he's got to go and bowl off spin at, is he Yorkshire?
Is it Yorkshire?
He's gone to Yorkshire. So, yeah, that's probably a good thing. He's had it too easy at Taunton when they prepared pitches that turn, really helpful to the spinners.
He was playing at Parrot Hill, which is Somerset's second 11 pitch. That's where they all play. And that one, honestly, it doesn't spin at all there. He never actually played at the county ground.
We'll be a bit like Headingley then. That's a spinner's paradise, isn't it, there?
Mm. Yeah, I think he might. I mean, in April as well, it's going to be tough for him to do enough to be selected, you'd have thought. The only thing that he has in his favour is the fact that he can bat at eight, and Jack Leach probably can't, and the tail looks quite long if you pick England's best seam attack.
Leach will play the whole summer as our spinner and will be our first line spinner for the foreseeable. I can't see Best removing him
over Moe Nally.
Leach, I think, gives you just a little bit more control in English conditions, whereas I think Ali is he just gives you far too many four balls.
Yeah, not Moe Nally. Yeah.
Ali's done now.
Ali's done, yeah. I know he did all right this series, but I think
he's also got terrible average as well. Average is like 40 with the ball. It's worse than Giles.
He got smashed around in India 4 years ago.
And Australia.
He had a better bowling average than Leach in this series.
And he didn't have to bowl on the flat pitch.
Yeah.
And the first test, which would have knocked Leach down a bit.
Fair enough. For all round, ratings then for Leach, Bess and Ali?
Leach A-, Ali B-, Bess
D,
C-.
There we go. Let's move on. We had a question from our listener, Wattie, received to our email address. Just remind us what the email address is, Wattie, for...
The email address is sticksandstokescricketpodcast@gmail.com.
Excellent. So we've had now Google, YouTube and Facebook, and now Marcus Little been in touch. And Marcus asks, is there a pundit, given the fact that we've focused quite a lot of our podcast so far on the punditry, from another sport or area of the media which we would like to see in the commentary box, and what would they bring to the punditry, to the analysis? Who wants to start us off?
Thank you, Marcus, for the question.
Thank you, Marcus.
Are you from Singapore, Marcus?
This is not the Marcus from Singapore. We maybe have two Marcuses listening. I think just from Ealing. Not quite as exotic.
Apparently, Piers Morgan's got a bit of spare time these days. Maybe we could get him in to mix things up a bit.
It could be like the reason he walked away from ITV is actually because he's considering an offer from the cricket pod.
Channel 4 have got a big offer lined up for him.
I could see him on TalkSport. I really could see him on there. He'd be just good on spouting TalkSport. Some controversial views.
Mm. I think Mark Nicholls will keep him in his place, hopefully. But yeah, as soon as he's left to run with all the others, oh god. what else? Any other ideas?
Well, it'd be quite nice to go a bit more old school, like how they used to be with Tony Gregg and Blowers and Boycott, and get David Starkey chairing it. His knowledge on history is fantastic, and you can never argue with someone who relates back to history all the time like Starkey does. I think he commands a room very well. He'd probably appeal. He's very smartly dressed, which is nice. I don't like all these horrible polo shirts that Nick Knight wears, and not just Nick Knight, but all the, Mark Butcher, I'm sure, wears one.
Did Starkey get fired for being a racist? Was that not him?
What did he do?
I'm sure he said something stupid.
Oh, yeah. Well, he called the SNP a bunch of Nazis, but I think that's fair enough.
There's a whole section on his Wikipedia page about controversial racist comments, so maybe he's the wisest one to have in the commentary box.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't like Black Lives Matter. Okay. So Mikey Holding can't be there. That's for sure.
I quite like Carragher and Neville's like dynamic on Monday Night Football. I feel like they could get some more sort of rivalry going from like learning from those two. Gary Neville used to play cricket as well, didn't he? I'm sure Gary Neville would have some like thoughtful things to say
about
cricket. Phil
Neville played with Flintoff.
Yeah.
He's supposed to. Yeah. I think Flintoff said Phil Neville was better than him when they were playing Lancashire schoolboys together.
I've imagined Carragher probably knows absolutely nothing about cricket, and that might be just quite funny to see like Neville sort of like having to like school them basically.
Well, KP and Goff on TalkSport, they were going at each other in quite a similar fashion. Mm. So maybe they'd be quite good on Sky Sports. But
I actually think KP was brilliant. I listened to a bit of that, and his how to play spin, like how he talked about it, how he basically had like a terrible time, I think, in India. And then he got like Rahul Dravid or supposedly on the phone, and then he sent him this like email or letter or whatever of like everything about how to play it. Quite interesting. He talked very well about that, actually.
I'm not sure Channel 4 can hire him though with Cook and Strauss in that.
That'd be
quite
funny.
The best relationship with those two.
Yeah.
Well, when one pundit's called another one a cunt on national TV, it doesn't really work, does it?
It could really work.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Well, thank goodness Channel 4 aren't going to be covering any more cricket for a while, because they really were abysmal, weren't they? Back home to Sky, where it belongs.
They unfortunately got they got dealt a pretty poor hand, didn't they, with basically all the two lockdown weekends when they could have got pretty decent ratings. The day-night test was over in 2 days before the Friday, and then another whole entire weekend chalked off thanks to England's inept batting performance.
Did anyone see Channel 4 on, I think it may have been a Saturday morning, when they had the guy from the Barmy Army on? And then they had these two blooming children on.
Just waving the whole time.
Two kids, like, what are you doing? They're just like 10 minutes talking to these two little brats about
their
favourite players
chat.
Was awful, awful cheap television. And yeah, that chap, I like the presenter of it, but he was, you know, humouring these little oiks, and they somehow got through it. But it was painful, and Paul Strauss was there with, you know, looking very awkward, but not as awkward as Cook was looking in the first test. It was terrible. You wouldn't get that on Sky Sports.
I would like to see from Sky Sports them to do the just one test, say the Lord's India test, and make one test a year free to air, where they do as a big sort of festival, like in partnership with BBC or Channel 4 or whatever, and like make one like a huge thing, like a national event, a bit like kind of Wimbledon becomes.
When the Queen goes down there and shakes all the opposition players' hands and stuff.
And make the whole thing like a festival kind of vibe. Yeah. You know, like get a load of people onto the nursery ground, make it, you know, like a bit like they do with like Murray Mound or whatever.
The BBC only promotes sports that they have. So, I mean, it's a constant gripe of mine that Sue Barker cons the whole country into thinking they're like tennis for 2 weeks a year because the BBC happen to have the rights to Wimbledon.
Isn't Sky Sports exactly the same? I've never seen so many netball adverts since they took over the rights to show women's netball.
No, it is, but the point is, think back to the Cricket World Cup, home World Cup, where we had a genuine chance of winning. Well, where we were the favourite, but we did win it. But before the World Cup was on, you'd be forgiven for not knowing.
Yeah.
My colleagues who aren't cricket fans going, well, yeah, what's this Cricket World Cup? It's on at the moment. It was appallingly badly
It was unforgivable that wasn't on free-to-air TV, the home World Cricket World Cup. I mean,
it was the final, wasn't it? Channel 4.
Yeah, but as a last minute thing, I mean, like, it was unforgivable that the rest of the World Cup wasn't.
Well, Wimbledon was on at the same time, and there were more people interested in watching two players who weren't even English in the final. Most pubs were showing the tennis.
Both of whom had already bloody won it a couple of several times each.
Yeah, exactly.
The only problem with this train of thought is that Sky aren't going to pay you more money to give away the rights to either one Test match a summer or the World Cup. So that just means there's less money in the game.
Yeah, slightly, but a lot more interest if that one big test is a way of getting people in there. And I think Sky would potentially do it, because if you looked at the way of how do you get more people to pay for Sky Sports, you know, Sky Cricket subscription, you need to get more people into cricket.
And you can charge more for the adverts when it's on free to air, can't you? Because your viewing figures will be much higher. So maybe Sky can just make it available on Freeview or whatever. Mm. So that, and then they can charge a fortune for the ad breaks compared to what they normally charge, which, okay, they still probably make a bit of a loss on it. But if you're buying Sky Sports, you're not going to go, oh, well, one game's free, so I won't buy it then this year.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. If you're into cricket, you'll do it. Well, they haven't probably decided yet what they're doing with the World Test final. Presumably that will be hidden away somewhere, pretty hard to watch.
YouTube.
Yeah.
Who cares?
I think it's a bit of a shame for that World Test Championship that they're doing it as just a one-off game. It'd been quite nice if it was a series, or at least, because one game, someone can just have a day out and win you the match. It'd be quite nice if it was at least.
I think it'd be a serious game. If you listen to Ravi Shastri talking about it, India were furious about the way that the point system was changed obviously midway through because of the pandemic.
It didn't favour them.
Well, they were top of the league and they went to third because they did it based on percentage of points rather than points. And it was Anil Kumble supposedly signed off the agreement to do so. And India are furious because what it meant was they had to go to Australia and win. And the fact that they did that with basically 15 injuries or like a whole first team out, pretty amazing. Like, they really wanted this. Even if they'd drawn in Australia and beaten us 4-0, that wouldn't have been enough for them.
How about if you have not just the final, have semi-finals as well? I mean, I'm not just saying this as an Englishman who would have loved to see England potentially get there, but why not have the top four? At the moment, the top four are head and shoulders above the rest, who are quite significantly weaker. Yeah.
We're in the top four.
Of course we're in the top four. So you could have two semi-finals where you have, say, India, Australia in one and England, New Zealand in the other.
We'd seed it, surely, so that the finishing first actually means something. So you get a home series against fourth place and second gets a home series against...
What series? Exactly. Would you not have four... You could have four teams and they just play back-to-back tests on the same...
Yeah, I'm thinking, I'm thinking they play...
loads of cricket.
They just one game, but played at the same time. So you could have, say that... I mean, the finals at Lords this year. So you could say the semis you have at whatever, at Old Trafford and Headingley or... And then the following week,
just have it at the back. The games from side by side.
Sounds like a bit of a farce. All this final and things of a test to be number one test team. It doesn't really sit well with me.
I agree. It's just money making rubbish.
Yeah, it's like this. It's like a World Cup super over and that sort of thing. It's just it's a bit of a joke.
It's creating context, isn't it? It's giving meaning to otherwise matches that seem to be just a perpetual endless cycle of random test series that happen.
I think I quite liked when England got to number one back in 2010, 2011. That was quite good, that you have a stint as the number one team. And then it just goes in sort of cycles as teams do very well. I'd have it that way personally, not this World Test Championship.
Best number one team of all time, I reckon, that England team. Better than Australia in the 90s.
West Indies
in the 80s.
Yeah, India now are special, you're right.
Yeah, I think they would give either of those teams a really good game. And they'd thrash them on a turning pitch.
Yeah, did that West Indies team in the 80s, did they have any spinners? Harry Sobers,
yeah. Fuxie, who else do they have?
Fuxie, have you looked up who Andy Roberts is yet? Because you didn't know who he was last time we spoke about it.
I'll cut this bit again.
I loved it in the last pod when Fuchs was asking about what the name of the trophy was if we play for the Alan Border Trophy against India.
I didn't think you did it.
Which is the best bit on the pod, and it didn't make it.
Of course not. So it's got to get some benefits to having to stay up all night.
The shittest job.
Yes.
Any other cricket that was happening? So Kieran Pollard hit Dananjaya De Silva for six sixes in the over, didn't he? And that was the over after he'd taken a hat trick. So, question to the panel: is it worth it taking a hat trick to get hit for six sixes next over? Would you?
No, because you go down in history as being the bowler that's gone for six sixes.
Yeah. I've had an expensive over or two in my time.
I should have not done that. That's a right statement. As our six sixes specialist.
So actually, from my view, I've never gone for six sixes, but
I've gone for more than six.
No balls don't help, and neither does the last ball of the innings in LMS counting for double if it goes for six. And unfortunately, I've had a few braces, but never a hat trick. And I would happily trade in another horrific over, and very much embarrassing over, in exchange for a hat trick, as I've never had one before. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, I suppose like if you feel like the horrific over is coming anyway, then take the hat trick. But
I wouldn't get that far, mate. just when you've had a few of them already, you can you can kind of take it a bit more. You've got thicker skin.
Fair enough. I think that's pretty much it. We're going to look ahead to this, obviously, one day matches coming up, which we don't really give a shit about. Although
unless we start winning, then we'll be talking about them in detail.
All over it.
Although the T20s are supposedly, according to Johnny, very meaningful, even though they're 6 months ahead of tournament. we've also got obviously county cricket coming up next month, starting in April, and looking ahead to a busy summer of test cricket. That'll be quite interesting, so probably preview that. And we've got
to see the listeners will go through the floor when we start talking about county cricket.
Then we'll really know who's an actual cricket fan and who's just listening to it until Krabby says something controversial again. We've also got some pretty mixed views on the 100, which will take prime place by the look of it this summer. So we'll potentially be debating that. And of course, it all builds up for the Ashes, doesn't it? That's the whole point. You know, apparently India away is just a training ground exercise where you rest and rotate players in and out, revolving door. You don't worry about treating that as a semi-final, even though the World Test Championship is at stake. Who are we to say? But obviously, building up to the Ashes will be quite interesting this summer. Any final thoughts, chaps, at the end of this mini-series, looking back on what's been a rollercoaster test series?
Well, there was one high bit, and then the rest has been constant down.
Well, it can only get better in the summer, back in English conditions. Nice little green seamer. We'll
get the Duke's balls back out.
Yeah.
Excellent. If you've got questions or if you want to get in touch,
either send us an email to sticksandstokescricketpodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter, where I think our handle is @sticksstokes, and I think we're also on Instagram. You'll probably be able to find us.
Excellent. Thanks very much, chaps.
Cheers, Pixie.
Cheers.
Cheers, lads. Bye. See you next time.